That's not what I meant. The Sociolinguistics of Everyday Conversation, Lecture 3. Framing and Reframing. How Meta-Messages Frame Meaning.
In this lecture, I'll introduce two key concepts. Framing is one, and a related concept of meta-messages, and that's spelled M-E-T-A, M-E-S-S-A-G-E-S, meta-messages. Framing is what makes it possible for us to use language in interaction. Words and phrases and sentences, all of these carry meaning, but framing tells us how to interpret that meaning. In the earlier lecture, I talked about linguistic signals, devices, and rituals. What these do is send meta messages, that is, a message about the message, telling you what the person speaking is doing. I gave the example where how are you could just be a ritual greeting, but sometimes it is an actual inquiry about health. The way you say it sends the meta message, this is a greeting, or this is an inquiry about your health. Is a remark meant to be friendly? Is it angry? Is it humorous? Everything about how you're supposed to interpret the meaning of the words would be the meta message. The terms and concepts framing and meta message trace to the anthropologist Gregory Bateson. He wrote an essay called A Theory of Play and Fantasy back in the 1950s, and also sociologist Irving Goffman, and he wrote a whole book about this, which he called Frame Analysis. Gregory Bateson developed his theory about framing watching monkeys at the Fleischacker Zoo in San Francisco. What he says is he went to watch the animals interacting, and he could see that the monkeys at times were playing with each other, but while they're playing with each other, they would bite each other. Now, how did a monkey know whether a bite was a literal bite, an aggressive act, or a friendly act? And so he concluded that the monkeys had some way of signaling to each other, that is, sending a meta message, this is play. And so the meta message, this is play, framed the interaction as play. You can see this among humans. We roughhouse, well, perhaps boys and men somewhat more than girls and women, but we all tease. We have ways of signaling to each other how we mean what we say, how we are framing the interaction. And I'll give you an example by reading from a field note, as I call it, that was written by a student in my class in cross-cultural communication. Throughout these lectures, I'll be giving examples from my students' field notes. What I require of the students is that as we read various articles about how language works in everyday life, the students observe interaction in their own everyday lives, and they write down observations that relate to the reading. So those would be field notes. Here's a description by Erica Dulks of some of her friends interacting Saturday night. She writes, Saturday night after a party, a group of us went to Matt's house to hang out before going home to bed. I and the other girls proceeded to sit down on the couch, and we began talking about the night. What we thought was fun, what we wished had happened. I was in the middle of giving my friend Sarah advice about a boy when all of a sudden, the coffee table was pushed out of the way, and the guys began to wrestle, throwing each other onto the couch, pushing each other off chairs. It was funny for me to see my big guy friends wrestling as if they were five-year-olds. And it's funny for us because it's an example of people interacting pretty much the way Gregory Bateson described monkeys in the zoo interacting. In other words, they're doing things that literally would be a fight, would be an attack, pushing them off chairs, wrestling each other to the floor, throwing each other onto the couch. But the way it's done sends a meta message, this is play. One of the interesting things about frames is that they're generally signaled implicitly. So you don't make an announcement, this is play. But the way you push each other around shows this is play. So it's signaled implicitly. So, for example, recall the question that I talked about in the previous lecture, where you might start by saying, where would you like to go for dinner? Or you might start by saying, let's go to Hamburger Hamlet, when you're trying to decide where to go for dinner. Neither person holds up a verbal sign, step one in negotiation, but that's how the utterances are intended, or you might say how they are framed. In other words, where would you like to go for dinner, is framing the interaction as deciding where to go for dinner. Throwing out a suggestion, let's go to Hamburg or Hamlet, is framing the interaction as start deciding where to go for dinner. Here's another example about how the way you speak frames how you mean what you say. I was talking to a friend of mine on the phone, kind of a leisurely long conversation, and at one point, I suddenly heard him say, "Stop it!" Now, somehow I knew that he wasn't yelling at me to stop what I was doing, but he was yelling at his dog, that his dog had begun doing something that he didn't want the dog to do. Now, the fact that I knew he had a dog played a role here, but the way he spoke, "Stop it!" Everything about the linguistic signals indicated to me, framed it as sending a meta message, this is telling a dog to stop what he's doing. Well, I thought it was funny, so I said something about it. And so we began talking about how he talks to his dog. And he told me, in talking about how he talks to his dog, he said, I say to him, "Go get that ball." Now, the dog doesn't understand the framing involved in I say to him, and so the dog took it as an invitation to play and began running around the living room looking for a ball. He didn't find one, so I think he found a stuffed frog. But dogs, as well as people, understand the meta message of how something is said to start an activity, and the activity is the frame. Jokes will often depend on frames and frame shifts. So let me give you an example of what I mean about that. Now, this is a joke that I've heard from my father. My father likes to tell jokes, and many of my joke examples will come from him. And this joke is takes place in a small village somewhere, probably a long time ago. So a man walks to the central square of the village, and he's holding a whip, and he offers to take people to the next village for half the usual fare. People think this is a bargain, and so he gathers a group of people, and they assume that he must have his wagon and horse parked pretty close, so they follow him. And they get to the square, and they pass the square. And they think, gee, I guess he must have left his horse and wagon on the outside of the outskirts of town. And they keep following him until they're halfway to the next village. And they say, hey, wait a minute, where's your horse and carriage? And he says, I don't have a horse and carriage. I said, I'll take you to the next village. And I am. I'm walking you to the next village. Well, why did they think that he had a horse and carriage? He didn't say that he did. It was the whip. So the whip signaled, you might say, a frame of I've got a horse and carriage or a horse and wagon, and the whip shows that I'm the person who's going to be getting the horse to go. So all of those assumptions went with the frame. You might say the whip was a signaling device that signaled that frame. Here's another joke, and this is one that my sister used to think was really funny at one time. A woman is in a restaurant, and she complains to the waiter. She says, waiter, there's something wrong with this chicken. One leg is longer than the other. And the waiter says, what are you going to do, eat it or dance with it? This joke is funny to the extent that it's funny because there is a frame shift. First, you're thinking about a dinner frame. You're the person who's going to eat. The chicken is the food. And you have a shift where one leg being shorter than the other makes you think of a person that you might want to dance with. And the idea of a person dancing with the chicken rather than eating it is humorous. So it's a frame shift that is signaled by the reference to one leg being shorter than the other that makes a shift from one frame to the other. A dinner where the chicken is food, a situation where you're going to dance. I'll give one more example. Not that these are the funniest jokes in the world, but they capture the idea about framing. A man is eating in a restaurant, calls over the waiter and says to the waiter, taste the soup. And the waiter says, why, what's wrong with the soup? Taste the soup. Well, what's wrong with it? Too much salt? Not enough salt? Taste the soup. So the waiter gives in. He says, okay. And he looks around and he says, where's the spoon? And the customer says, see? So the problem wasn't the soup, but the spoon, that there wasn't a spoon. And the joke is funny to the extent that it's funny because there's a frame shift. You're first in a frame where in tasting the soup, the focus is on the soup and whether the soup is good or not, shifting to a frame where the focus is on the utensil that you would need to taste the soup. And so calling attention to the soup is simply a means to call attention to the spoon or the lack of a spoon. And you can go over pretty much any joke that you think of that you think is funny and probably trace it to some frame shift. I want to give you some more extended examples now of a study of framing that I did some years back together with a social psychologist, Cynthia Wallet. We were studying medical interaction. The Child Development Center is a division of the Georgetown University Hospital that was set up to help families whose children had various medical or developmental problems. So families would come to the center and would be seen by a whole range of physicians and healthcare professionals. My colleague Cynthia Wallet and I followed rather closely a series of videotapes that had been made by the center involving a mother, a child who had cerebral palsy, and a physician who was examining the child in the mother's presence. After looking closely at these interactions, we realized that one of the most important things going on was the framing of the interaction. Looking at how frames were operating helped us understand problems that were caused, satisfactions and dissatisfactions, and also the extra burden that was placed on the physician. So let me present this study in a little bit more detail. Georgetown University is a teaching hospital, and so the physician who was examining the child with cerebral palsy in the presence of the mother was having her interaction taped and assumed that those tapes would later be watched by medical residents, that is, doctors in training at Georgetown University Hospital. When she talked, she used three very different, what linguists would call, registers. That is, she had ways of talking to the child, talking to the mother, and talking to the audience that would someday watch this videotape in three very different ways, and we call those different ways registers. So let me first illustrate these different registers. Here's an example of the register that the doctor used when she was talking to the child. So she's examining the child, and she says, "Let me look in your ear. Do you have a monkey in your ear?" And the child laughs, "No." And the doctor, "No. Let's see. I see a birdie. No, no." So the doctor is using a kind of high pitch, a sing-song, playful register that shows she's addressing herself to the child. When the doctor talks to the mother, she uses a conversational register that would be maybe toward the formal end, but more or less what you would expect in an average conversation. So the mother expresses a concern, and the doctor says in answering, "As you know, the important thing is that she does have difficulty with the use of her muscles." So that's the register that the doctor used in talking to the mother. The doctor also used at times a register that we call a reporting register. And this seems to be addressed to the residents who might one day watch the video. But it's also a register that she uses to report what she's observing in her examination. So it's probably a reflection of the internal notation that she's making of what she's observing. So, for example, when she looks in the ears, she says, "Her canals are fine, they're open, her tympanic membrane was thin and light." So it's a reporting register because of the flat intonation and also the technical terms that she's using that would clearly not be addressed to the mother or the child, tympanic membrane, for example. Now, it was interesting for us in analyzing these interactions to see how the doctor shifted registers. And clearly, this is something that she did very automatically and very fluidly. And I'll just give you an example here of a short excerpt where you can see her moving between the three registers. This is what it sounded like. And the doctor is about to look in the child's mouth, and she says, "Let's see. Can you open up like this, Jody? Look." And the doctor opened her own mouth really wide. And the child says, the dad says, "Good. That's good." Seeing for the palate, she has a high arch palate, but there's no cleft. What we'd want to look for is to see how she moves her palate, which might be some of the difficulty with breathing that we're talking about. So the three registers are the teasing register that she uses with the child. Good. That's good. The register she uses for the what we call the reporting register to talk to the residents, seeing for the palate. She has a high arch palate, but there's no cleft. So you hear the flat intonation and the technical terminology, palate, cleft. And then the conversational register that she uses with the mother. What we'd want to look for is to see how she moves her palate. The mother had been expressing some concern about the child's breathing because with cerebral palsy, muscle control is weak, and so the breathing sounds noisy. And this was a concern that the mother reported. I want to point out now, and this is where the element of framing became so important, that simply seeing how the doctor switches registers doesn't really capture how difficult her job is. Within each register, there are at least three different frames, or even four, that the doctor is addressing. And so, whenever she talks to the child, she uses this kind of teasing register, but she balances several different frames in talking to the child. So sometimes she has to examine the child, and we saw her doing that, teases her while she's doing that. But sometimes she has to entertain the child just to keep her comfortable in the situation. It's part of just kind of managing the social situation. When she's in her training mode, that is addressing the need to be an exemplary pediatrician so that the people watching the videotape will learn how to be a good pediatrician, that's a whole other thing that she's doing while she's teasing the child. And then there are times when she's consulting with the mother, and this was a very interesting one. The on-record frame, you might say, the thing the doctor was there to do was to examine the child, and she's going to write a report about what she found out about the child. But because the mother is there, this examination frequently turns into a consultation because the mother has a child with cerebral palsy. She has a lot of concerns about the child's health. The pediatrician is a source of knowledge. She can answer questions that the mother has. And so the mother frequently interrupts the pediatrician's examination to ask questions about the child's health. But these do serve a very different frame. That gets the doctor out of the examination frame and into a consultation frame. And in fact, when we showed the videotape after the fact to the mother and separately to the doctor. And the mother commented that this doctor was really good, that she had taken the child to many, many doctors, and this doctor was really good. She was great at explaining things and answering questions and talking in a way that really helped her understand her child's condition better. The doctor commented that when she sees patients in her private office, that she often doesn't allow the parent to be in the room because it does interrupt the examination, and so she puts the parent behind a mirror, a one-way mirror, so that the parent can see what's happening, but the child doesn't see the mother or the father or the caretaker behind that mirror, so that she can do her examination without interruption. And she gives the parent or the caretaker a piece of paper and a pencil so that they can write down any questions that they have, and she answers the questions later. But this was something that we found out just from thinking about the interaction in terms of frames. When the doctor talks to the mother, she uses what we call this conversational register, but she talks to the mother in a number of different frames. So, for example, in just managing the social situation frame, she has to establish rapport with the mother, make conversation. In terms of the pediatric examination, she has to ask the mother for information that the mother has that may be relevant to the child's condition. But that's still in the examination frame. That doesn't get her out of the examination frame. Again, with regard to the residents that may be later watching the videotape, she still has to keep in mind being an exemplary pediatrician. The biggest frame switch is when she has to answer the mother's questions, which comes as a interruption, as I put it, of the examination frame. So the mother has a number of questions that she wants to ask the doctor. Now, when the doctor is answering the mother's questions, she has to suppress her emotions. She has to blunt the impact of the diagnosis on the mother. And this is a comment that the mother made to us about why this was such a good doctor, that she had actually had the experience of taking her child to a doctor and have the doctor tell her devastating information in a way that didn't at all take into account the emotional impact on her. She even said one time a doctor said to her, in effect, your baby is going to be a vegetable, and then went on with the interaction, you know, taking without at all taking into account the emotional impact on the mother. This physician was very aware of the impact of what she was saying on the mother, and there was a very interesting example of this. At one point, the mother asked the doctor about the danger to the child of a diagnosis she had gotten, that the child had arteriovenous malformations in her brain. This is something that she was concerned about, she'd been told about, but she didn't really understand the implications. And she asked the doctor, and it came as an interruption of the examination. She asked the doctor, "I often wonder about how dangerous they are to her right now." And the doctor answered in a way that really seemed to play down the danger. She said something like, "The only danger would be from bleeding from them, which could happen, but they aren't going to be any real danger to her right now." And the mother was reassured. We had the opportunity to compare how the doctor spoke in this context with how she spoke in another context. There was a meeting of all the healthcare professionals that had seen this child, and they all met together and talked about their observations. In the context of talking to the other professionals, the doctor said there was a danger that these could rupture, and that would be lethal. And so it really was much more dangerous than she had made clear to the mother. Now, she had said that to the mother. She had said the danger would be bleeding. Now, of course, using the word bleeding and using the word hemorrhage is very different. But also the tone. Again, we're looking here at conversational signals, linguistic signals, and how they frame what you think you're doing. Focusing again on the importance of linguistic signals and how they send a meta message about the frame. The tone of voice in which the doctor spoke when she answered the mother's question was reassuring. It seemed to send a meta message, "I'm reassuring you. The only danger would be bleeding from them, which can happen." The way she said, "which can happen," makes it sound like it's not a very significant danger. I think it was important for the doctor to give the information in this way, in that context, because she really wasn't in a situation where she could counsel the mother fully. She was there to do an examination. But understanding the pressure on her of balancing these different frames and the way she used linguistic signals to send meta messages to do these various things is what I'm trying to focus on in this analysis. And so the register, the conversational register of addressing the mother is only the first step. If we understand it in terms of framing and how her use of linguistic signals were framing what she was doing and how she shifted from one frame to another, that is, from examining the child to consulting with the mother, we begin to really understand the kinds of pressures that this doctor was under. I want to read you one last little interaction here from this study that shows you how a cognitive burden is created by having to balance more than one frame at once. A way that I talk about it is that it was a leaky frame, and so she's using the register of teasing the child, but the information comes in from the frame of examining the child and reporting to the residents that would someday watch the videotape. So the child is lying on the examining table, and the doctor is examining her abdomen, her stomach. And she's speaking in this teasing register to the child, and she says, "Okay, all right, now let me see what I can find in there. Is there peanut butter and jelly?" Wait a minute, and the child says, "No." And the doctor says, "No peanut butter and jelly in there?" And the child says, "No." She's laughing. And she has a conversational register here because she's just managing the interaction. She says to the child, "Bend your legs up a little bit." That's right. And then we get the teasing register again, and she says, okay, any peanut butter and jelly in there? No, there's nothing in there. Is your spleen palpable over there? No. So by saying, is your spleen palpable over there, in a teasing register, I think what happens here is that the doctor is using the teasing register to manage the interaction, manage the child, entertain her so she can do the examination. But in her mind, she's having to note what she's feeling for and realizes that she's feeling for the spleen, and that kind of leaks into the teasing register. Just as the mother reacted to the meta message of reassurance in the way the doctor answered the mother's question about the danger of the AV malformations, the child reacts to the teasing register. And so when the doctor says, is your spleen palpable over there? The child says, no. So she's reacting to being teased. And that's the job of framing. The linguistic signals, the way that she asked the question, signaled teasing, a teasing frame, and that's what the child responded to. I also draw a distinction in this study that I did with Cynthia Wallett of these interactions involving the doctor, the mother, and the child with cerebral palsy. I make a distinction between frames on the one hand and schemas on the other. Schemas are actually a kind of frame. I use the term schema to refer to systems of associated knowledge that we think go together. So, for example, we have an idea of kind of what goes on when you go to a doctor's office. And so you might say to the doctor, I want to talk about the appointment. You know that when you go to the doctor, you make appointments. You don't have to start from scratch and explain all the background. The doctor and the mother have different schemas for cerebral palsy. So the doctor keeps trying to reassure the mother that she shouldn't worry about the child's breathing because the child is getting enough oxygen. Because cerebral palsy involves poor muscle control, the way the doctor puts it is her breathing sounds kind of floppy. But the mother doesn't have that schema for cerebral palsy. The mother's schema is when you hear noisy breathing, it means difficulty breathing. And so at several points in the examination, the mother interrupts the examination to ask questions about the child's breathing. So the schema mismatch, you might say, triggers a shift in frames, makes the doctor stop the examination and shift to the consultation frame. What we saw in this study is how thinking about linguistic registers is very useful. It helps us understand how we use linguistic signals to show who we're talking to. So the doctor had the teasing register when addressing the child, a conversational register when addressing the mother, and a reporting register when talking to the residents or kind of talking out loud to report what she's doing, which would later be heard by the residents who are watching the video. But the concept of register really doesn't capture the complexity of what's going on in interaction. The concept of framing is what captures that. With each register, the doctor addressed the mother, the child, and the residents. But within those registers, she was balancing these competing and potentially conflicting frames, managing the interaction, examining the child, being an exemplary physician for kind of being a model physician, demonstrating being a doctor for the tape, and consulting with the mother. Thinking of it in terms of frames and understanding how frames work in interaction helps us understand the real cognitive burden of taking part in an interaction. Now, this one is a specific example of a doctor in a medical examination interview, but just about any interaction that any of us take part in, you can pick apart what are the various frames that you're addressing yourself to, and how are you using linguistic signals to create registers, that is, show who you're talking to, but also to create frames. The concept of schema was also useful. It's a kind of frames because it helped us understand what might trigger the frame shift from examining the child to consulting with the mother. In this instance, it was the different schemas, that is, a sets of knowledge and understanding that the mother had about cerebral palsy compared to the one that the doctor had. So the concepts of framing and of meta-messages will remain crucial in all the lectures that follow because anything that we say in any conversation has to be interpreted in terms of the frame, that is, what it is you think you're doing by talking in this way at this time. Meta-messages are the way you signal that frame, how you clue in the person you're talking to and how you interpret from other people's talk the frame that you believe the person is in. What do you think they're doing? What do you think they intend? What's the activity? What's their attitude toward you and what you're talking about? So the concepts of meta messages and framing will be crucial for all the following lectures. The topic of the next lecture is another concept that's going to be crucial for every interaction and for all the lectures, and that is a concept that linguists talk about as power and solidarity.
This ends Lecture 3.